This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. When Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders announced he would endorse Hillary Clinton for president on Tuesday, his action sparked relief from members of the Democratic Party establishment and anger from his core supporters. Sanders' reasoning? Donald Trump. Enough said. But my guest, Professor Eddie Glaude, wrote in Time magazine, quote, "Donald Trump is just an exaggerated indication of the rot that is at the heart of this country. That fact of Trump alone and the Democratic anguish that goes with it cannot be the only rationale to support Hillary Clinton. Something more substantive is required of us and of her." Professor Glaude added, "I cannot vote for her." He now joins me to explain why. Eddie S. Glaude Jr. is chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University and the author of Democracy in Black. His article in Time was called My Democratic Problem with Voting for Hillary Clinton. Welcome to the show, Professor Glaude.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, your article has gotten a lot of traction, and I think it seems to capture this moment in our history when people who were so excited about the possibility of a different kind of candidate, Bernie Sanders, kind of echoing their values, end up having to step down for various reasons. And it feels like we're just back to square one. Like, even though Sanders is saying his political revolution is going to continue, in practical terms, in the short term, doesn't matter very much. It feels like that was all for naught. Is that essentially how you feel about it?
Well, you know, I never invested my political hopes and aspirations in Bernie Sanders' campaign. Let me say that first and foremost. I voted for him in New Jersey, but it wasn't as if I held the view that his success in running for the presidency amounted to or constituted the end and be all of what was required in this moment. I think we're in the middle of a democratic awakening. And the Sanders campaign was just one bloom among many that we see around the country. And so the passage you read from the article, I think, is absolutely right, that people are saying that the problem is Donald Trump. And I want to suggest that something else, that there's something much more fundamental that's the problem. And that is that the way we currently live our lives is no longer sustainable. We can't live our life. We can't live in a country with this kind of income inequality. We can't live in a country where the country bombs other people around the globe into oblivion. Police are locking up black and brown people, and folks who are supposed to serve and protect are killing black and brown women at alarming rates. Our public school systems are failing. That we have an eviscerated conception of the public good, where the rich get richer. And politicians' role is to make us believe that that's in our best interest. So the argument is that Donald Trump is just an exaggerated indication of all of that that I just described. And the question for us to ask, will Hillary Clinton change anything?
And in fact, is Hillary Clinton not a symbol of some of those things that you were saying? Maybe not as horrifically, you know, extreme as Trump, but in many ways, I mean, when you're talking about foreign policy, for example.
Oh, absolutely. Her hawkishness. I still remember her saying that we needed to send those children back to Central America, right? We need to send them back. So her policy around immigration, she's a neoliberal. So when you think about her policies in relation to Wall Street and the working class, her waffling around, you know, the trans, TPP, the way in which she had to be forced to think about or to commit herself to a $15 a livable wage, there's nothing about Hillary Clinton and her past that would lead us to infer that she will fundamentally change and embrace a progressive agenda moving forward. And so the question for us, those of us who embrace the moniker of being left or progressive in some serious and genuine sense, we have to ask ourselves the question, right, are we willing to concede to business as usual? And I'm reminded of, perhaps I could paraphrase Henry David Thoreau. There will come a time when, without disgrace, we must disassociate ourselves from them. And that's what I tried to do in the piece in Time.
Interestingly enough, very early on, progressives like Tom Hayden and even really Noam Chomsky made it very clear that if it came down to Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump, people should vote for Clinton. In fact, Hayden went even further, choosing Clinton over Sanders. What do you make of that?
Well, I think Noam Chomsky's Hayden. That's confusing to me. And it reveals much about where he is politically. Noam Chomsky's position is a little bit more nuanced, I think, and it's closer to my own. I'm in New Jersey. I'm in a blue state, and in the time piece, I'm very clear. I said the only compelling reason that you have to vote for Hillary Clinton is to keep Trump from winning the presidency. To me, that's the only compelling reason, unless you're a neoliberal, right? Unless she mirrors or reflects your politics. But because I'm in New Jersey, a decidedly blue state, I can make a choice to vote, to be a conscious voter. But there are people in battleground states, like Ohio and Florida and Pennsylvania, where it makes all the sense in the world to me for them to vote for Clinton, right? And then there are people in, and let's call those pivotal voters. And then there are people who are in Mississippi and Texas and Alabama, decidedly red states, and let's call those pressure voters. So if they vote for Hillary Clinton, it's almost as the same as not voting at all. Because we know those states are going to end up voting for Trump. So part of what I think Chomsky was arguing, and what I'm suggesting as well, in a broader piece that I'm writing, that I've written with a political scientist out of Columbia University, Frederick Harris, is that we be strategic voters. That some of us can say I prefer not. Others should turn out in massive numbers and vote for Clinton and vote down ballot, because I'm going to be voting down ballot. And others can do the same. Right. So we just need to be strategic.
Professor Glaude, are you then saying that if you did live in a swing state, you would hold your nose and vote for Clinton? And if so, you know, none of the arguments around, you know, Clinton being a lesser evil that we shouldn't vote for hold.
Well, no, I think for me, I would have to really struggle with it. I mean, we have to do two things simultaneously here. And I'm not backtracking. I'm not backwalking the claim in the essay. I'm just trying to be nuanced and strategic in my thinking. We have to do two things simultaneously, and this is a difficult thing to do. One is that we have to say that business as usual is no longer acceptable, that the status quo must be fundamentally transformed. And two, we have to keep Trump out of office, right? Now, how do we do those things simultaneously? Well, we have to bring pressure to bear on politics as usual, and particularly the kind of corporate-controlled Democratic Party. We have to begin to reclaim the legitimacy of a left politics in the United States at the public, at the national level, and at the local level. And we have to, in some ways, respond to the neo-fascist turn of the right. And we have to do that in a responsible way. So I'm saying if it is the case, and I say this in the piece, mm-hmm. that you have to vote for Trump, I can completely understand
Clinton.
That. But I'm not. Mm. I mean, vote for Clinton, but right. I'm not.
Yeah. Okay, so we can say somebody living in a swing state like Florida feels compelled to vote for Clinton because they want to keep Trump out. Even if they don't back Clinton, we won't blame them. Well, would you blame somebody who said, I don't care that I live in a swing state. I cannot bring myself to vote for Clinton. Trump gets into office, people turn around and blame those who didn't vote for Clinton or blame them for voting for, say, somebody like Jill Stein. And that is held over progressive voters' head, the Ralph Nader effect on the Bush-Gore election. And I think we're going to see so much of that between now and November for those people living in swing states. What are your thoughts on that?
I think the social science around the quote-unquote Nader effect is complicated. Folk are just kind of using that as a hammer to beat us over our heads. I think it would be I would be more interested, and I'm speaking from the African-American community, at least from my position within the African-American community here, it's amazing to see how white Clinton supporters are so, and even some black Clinton supporters are so vehement in insisting that we vote for Clinton, even though she hasn't put forward specific policies to address the conditions of our communities, and have said little to nothing about the white folks who are supporting Trump. And what do I mean by that? It seems as if the Democratic Party in particular, and Clinton support, the Democratic Party in general, and Clinton supporters in particular, seem to place the burden of holding off the neo-fascism of the right on the shoulders of people of color, on the shoulders of voters, when in fact, that's all the Democratic Party has to do is turn its back on its corporate commitments, turn its back on its neoliberal commitments. But it refuses to do that. The only thing the Democratic establishment is putting forward, right, is the fear of Trump, is the fear of Trump. And so if that's all you have and people aren't excited, that's not our fault. That's your fault. That's your fault. But they want to blame us. So I refuse to let that stick. That stick is not going to make me move at all. So if you're in a swing state and they're not putting forward an agenda that's consistent, right, with the commitments that you think will fundamentally transform this state, I completely understand your decision. But I will say I completely understand the decision of some people who will hold their noses and vote for Clinton. I understand that as well.
Yeah. And the Sanders, the one thing that the Sanders campaign really showed, which may be the most sort of interesting and valuable thing coming out of it, is that the Sanders campaign showed that if you actually, take positions with strong progressive values, you do have a lot of traction. And the Democrats for years have been attempting to win the same voters that the Republicans are going after, leaving progressives high and dry, leaving progressives with very few choices.
I mean, that's so right, Sonali. I mean, look, coming out of the Center for American Progress, I mean, you can't get any more centrist than that. Stephen Phillips wrote a wonderful book about,
Yes, we had him on our program talking about that, yeah.
Right. And so the coalition is already there, right? We are, they talk about that Clinton has to, in some ways, duplicate the Obama coalition of 2012, right? And they say that's what she has to do. But at the same time, what she's doing is appealing to that median voter, who we know is the median white voter in Western Pennsylvania, right? And so part of what we need to just kind of confront, and I think Thomas Frank has made this very clear with Listen Liberal, is that the Democratic Party has been a shell of itself. It is completely under the sway of corporate interest. In some ways, and I say this in the piece, we want to run to safety when in fact we might be running straight into danger. Because we must always remember it is the Democratic Party that passed welfare reform. It's the Democratic Party that dismantled Glass-Steagall. It's the Democratic Party, right, that passed the crime bill, right? It's on the Democratic Party's watch that we've seen in interesting sorts of ways since Reagan, right, the transfer of wealth, the continued transference of wealth into the hands of the top 0.1%. And so we need to just be clear that what we're dealing with is not two separate parties, right, with two clear and distinct ideologies, right? We're dealing with one that's crude and crass, and the other is slick and sophisticated and sly. We're dealing with foxes and lions.
Now, I want to talk about the issue of symbolism, Professor Glaude. When Barack Obama ran for president, partly because he was a blank slate and people, as a junior senator, people really didn't have a sense of his record, but also partly because he is extremely brilliant and intelligent and very skillfully spoke to people's horror over the Bush years, he was elected with a lot of hopes in place. Now, Clinton is a different issue because, of course, there's a very long record that we can examine of her, but there's still that symbolic value that a lot of people place a lot of cachet on, which is that she's a woman and that it is very important for us to have the first woman president. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard people conflate legitimate critiques of Clinton with imagined sexism. There is real sexism against Clinton, but I feel like there's a lot of imagined sexism too as a cover for her conservatism. What do you think?
Absolutely. I think in some ways people are doing a disservice to the critical and analytic power of feminism when they make that argument. Some people are, I mean, you're absolutely right. There are some sexist critiques of Clinton that we need to call out. But, you know, I'm not a fan of choice liberalism. I mean, choice feminism. I'm not a fan of neoliberal feminism or lean in feminism. Right. I'm a liberation feminist in this sense. Right. That it's not just simply the fact of Clinton being a woman that ought to determine whether or not we support her. If that was the case, then we would support Margaret. We would have celebrated Margaret Thatcher. Right. And she, along with Reagan, devastated the world in some ways. Right. And part of what we have to do is begin to assess Hillary Clinton's policies and what they would mean for vulnerable women and children around the world. What would her hawkishness do? Right. How would she fundamentally impact U.S. aid policy? What are her economic policies? What would that mean for the vulnerable children and women around the world? How might her immigration policy affect children and women who are disproportionately impacted by war-torn areas? In other words, we need to assess, right, her actions over and against policies that are in light of our own broader commitment to a feminist liberation ethic. And that seems to me that cuts against a kind of easy, facile identity politics, because we've seen that movie before. People were all excited about Barack Obama, excited about the idea of a black president. And here we are 8 years later, and I'm not resting this solely at his feet, but 8 years later, African-American communities are in ruins because we didn't vet policies. We didn't ask what will you actually do to respond to the conditions of black communities. And let's be clear, Obama was, and at least this campaign, was brilliant in jumping in front of an extraordinary mobilization of grassroots energy from WTO to the millions of people around the globe protesting the Iraq war. Obama then became the object of that energy and then subsequently demobilized it. And I don't want Clinton to do something similar in this moment.
What do you make of those people who want to use the vehicle of electoral politics to enact change and are really interested in seeing it being done through third parties like the Green Party? One of the things that has happened the day that Bernie Sanders endorsed Hillary Clinton, seeing reports that donations to Jill Stein's candidacy with the Green Party jumped hugely. And a lot of people are saying, well, I have a new option. I was going to vote for Sanders. I'm now going to vote for Stein. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I think we need to break the back of the two-party system in this country. It's going to be very difficult. It has that the two-party system in this country has a long storied history. It's entrenched in our political culture. But we know around the world there are multiple parties vying for the support of their citizenry. So I think it's a good thing for our democracy. I would love to see and hear more specifics from the Green Party around the question of racial inequality in this country and how we're going to address it specifically. And I have to look at that more carefully for myself. But I think it's a healthy thing because, you know, one of the more insidious dimensions of this moment is that they want us to believe, whoever they may be, that the only thing that our only choices are those choices right in front of us. They want the American public to believe that our only choices are the choices right in front of us. And we need to understand that democracy is under assault in this country. My colleagues here at Princeton have argued that, in fact, we're no longer a democracy, we're an oligarchy. I want to suggest that it's in our hands. We have to do something bold, radically imaginative in this moment. And the first thing we need to do is to say no to the options in front of us and do something dramatic. And that might begin at the local level and be networked across the country to have a national implication. But we need to let the powers be. We need to let them know that there is a substantive shift, right, in the center of gravity in this country, and that they should be shaking in their boots.
Well, Eddie S. Glaude Jr., I want to thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your thoughts with us. We will certainly provide a link to your article in Time Magazine from our page later today. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
Professor Glaude is chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University. He's the author of Democracy in Black. We've been discussing his article in Time called My Democratic Problem with Voting for Hillary Clinton. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.